Session number 1110 Reel 3.
Commander Page, Reel 3. Now, jumping ahead in your career to 1944, can you tell me what job you had, what capacity you served in at the time of D-Day, please?
Well, about 2 months prior to D-Day, I'd been promoted to be the commanding officer of a Spitfire squadron, which was in 83 Group, which was the forward attack group designated for the invasion of Normandy, and we were based at an airfield just near Arundel in Sussex called Ford Aerodrome.
What was the squadron?
Number 132 Fighter Squadron. And our task prior to D-Day consisted mainly of a very enjoyable business of two or three times a day attacking the V-1 flying sites, which were based up in the northern part of France in the Pas-de-Calais area, and then fighter sweeps, and then dive bombing marshalling yards at places like Arras and Beauvais and Amiens, anything to disturb the German communication system when D-Day itself actually came, which we were unaware of until the night before D-Day itself. And then we were told that we were confined to camp, and the squadron commanders were brought into a conference with the group captain station commander, and we were given large documents with all the maps and orders for the invasion. And then the job of my squadron was to be over the American beaches of Omaha and Utah at first light on D-Day, and to just keep a fighter patrol over the beaches. Then we'd get relieved after about an hour, then we'd come back to England, have a meal, refuel, and go back over the beaches again. From my point of view, I think I mentioned it earlier, it was fascinating to see our troops and the Americans and others, Canadians, going into France again. And of course, sitting over the beaches at about 1,000 feet, one had a, you know, really a dress circle view of the whole of the Normandy landing. We felt sorry for the troops, because who were coming across in the landing craft. There were thousands of vessels, from big battleships down to little landing craft, and the little landing craft were taking a tremendous pounding from the bad weather conditions. The channel was rough, and I was thinking a tremendous number of them were being ill from seasickness. And then, of course, to get out of a landing barge on a beach and to be fired at and to be a brave man and attack the enemy is not the easiest thing in the world. So, as I say, we felt sorry for them, because after we'd been there about an hour, we'd go fly back to England when our relief came out, and we'd tuck into a breakfast, and we'd be comfortable while those poor chaps were still out there on the beaches. And that was our sort of several times a day routine, going back out over the beaches. And it became a little boring, in fact, after a while, because the Germans, I think, thought that the Normandy invasion was a dummy attack, and they put up no aircraft resistance at all. I believe two German fighters, which I never saw, came over once during the first fortnight of the landing time. But we moved after a few days from England. We moved into a prepared sort of mud airstrip in Normandy, and we operated from there. And our main task then was attacking anything that moved on the roads in the way of vehicles that were remotely connected with German support. So we were kept busy all day long, going out, attacking, landing again, rearming our guns with ammunition and fuel and going out again. So that side of life was much more interesting than the first few days of the actual landing itself.
Which personnel did you prefer, fighting enemy aircraft in the air or these ground attacks?
Oh, enemy aircraft, without question. That's exciting. Attacking anything on the ground, it has an element of excitement because it's quite dangerous because you just don't know who's shooting at you, whereas in the air you've got a rough idea that there's another enemy aircraft or several and they're shooting at you. Whereas there can be anti-aircraft guns all over the place on the ground, even a soldier with his own machine gun.
Presumably at this stage of the war you were much more heavily armed than you were in 40.
Yes, we'd got cannons in our Spitfires, plus machine guns. All that had improved, and the actual aircraft themselves had been improved in their performance. So we had no complaints from that point of view.
Could you see to what extent you were managing to get successes against the ground targets?
Well, very much so with vehicles that you were attacking, because most of the time, and we were getting pretty experienced at shooting at stuff on the ground, the thing would just blow up and explode in flames. So you'd come back and fill in your report and just sort of say three or four enemy trucks, and you'd give a map reference, destroyed. If it didn't blow up or turn over or something like that, you'd just say it was damaged. We in our Spitfires, the only thing that we really couldn't harm were the German Panzer tanks. They were so heavily armour-plated. But our Typhoon fighter bombers with their rockets, they dealt with them very effectively. In places like the Falaise Gap. In fact, the Typhoons, I think, really made the breakout of the beachhead possible by their destruction of the German armoured corps there.
When you were attacking the V1 sites, how difficult or easy were they to attack?
That was a most unpleasant job, really, because you go over at about 12,000 feet. It's a specially selected height because light anti-aircraft fire, such as 20mm or 40mm cannon fire, that trails off at about 10,000 feet, and the heavy anti-aircraft fire, which can go way up, that's pretty ineffective under about 14,000 feet. So we soon found that there was this sort of 2,000 foot layer where the heavy gun was firing at an altitude which was inefficient for it at this lower altitude, and the lighter guns couldn't get up to where we were. So you'd fly over 12, you're all with 500 pound bombs underneath our Spitfires. And as the squadron commander, you had the responsibility of finding the target, but obviously you'd done a lot of work on the ground before you left, looking at photographs made by the photographic reconnaissance people, maps, etc., etc. And these flying bomb sites consisted of three basic units. There'd be two small little concrete buildings, and then there was a thing we used to call a ski jump, rather like the Olympic Games where the skiers do the ski jumps, and that was the launching ramp for the V1 itself. So you'd peel off at 12,000 feet when you got yourself just about vertically over the target, and then scream straight down. But the unattractive part of that operation was that the Germans would put a cone of anti-aircraft fire. They had the whole site ringed with these light 40mm guns, and they would put a cone right up over the target, so as you dive down, and you were sitting on top of a 500-pound bomb, you had to go through all this fire, which you could, anti-aircraft fire, which you could see bursting in puffs of little grey smoke. And as you went through, you just prayed to the Almighty that your bomb or aircraft wasn't going to be hit. But once you were through that, then you released your bomb. You'd then climb away and with a sigh of relief and head back to England. I think statistics have shown that this wasn't a very effective way of attacking the V1 sites, but they didn't know better. In fact, the V1 sites, because of the smallness of these two little buildings and the ski jump, were difficult targets to knock out. Also, the American lighter bombers, the Mitchells and Marauders, they tried attacking them in just straight bombing runs. But again, the success rate wasn't enormous. And I think that England and London in particular would have had a very rough time if the Allied troops hadn't burst out of the beachhead and captured the Pas-de-Calais area of France where all these V1s were being launched.
Did you lose many planes on the V1 site attack?
Not too many. No, I think by and large we probably lost more attacking the trucks and other vehicles on the roads. Don't ask me why, but that's just the way it worked out. But it wasn't a pleasant job.